Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything you can possibly think of, has its own history, like potatoes, banjos, and partridges.
In a pear tree, or prams, spams, dams, iams, it's all about me, lambs and whams last Christmas. This got me thinking about Christmas tunes. And have you heard of this phenomenon called Whamageddon this year, Sam?
No, I read it in the paper, but I didn't follow up what it was.
Basically what it is, this was in The Guardian the other day, being such left-leaning connoisseurs of the newspaper that we are. This is basically the idea that you should not listen to Wham's Last Christmas from the start of Advent through to beyond Christmas. And already I have failed miserably with this because I must have heard it at least 20 times already. Every shop you seem to walk into is either Wham's Last Christmas or Mariah Carey. It's that time of year. Just imagine if you were working in a store where they had Christmas tunes on all the time and one Christmas album that they played on repeat throughout the Christmas period. I really, God, it would drive me absolutely mad. However, this is to digress as ever, because what we really should be doing, and what we will be doing, we can guarantee you, dear listeners, is following the links in our mind as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, that the history of debt is in fact all about the age of American independence, character, morality and charity, debtor's prison and the material culture of debt. It's about the law and punishment via Charles Dickens. It's about genealogy and discovering skeletons in closets, debtors in your family tree. It's about economic bubbles, including the South Sea bubble and tulip mania. It's about King Croesus. It's about tally sticks and the Roman view of ethics on the acquisition of art. Of course it is. Or who knew that the history of teenagers is in fact all about the lost generation in China during the Cultural Revolution? It's about oral history, bedrooms and anthropology, 20th century US pop culture and high schools. Who knew?
Such good episodes, both of those. My fellow presenter, who is this man talking to you? If history were a flock of lost wandering sheep, cold in the mountain winds, he would be the kindly whistling shepherd, finding everyone, every member of his historical flock, however injured, lonely or sick, and he would bring them home to warmth in his hearth with his whistle and crooks of research. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's Professor James Daybell.
Hello, and our minds are on similar tracks here. You may well be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a shepherd-related historian, he'd only be the good shepherd himself, tending to his historical flock, protecting them from the wolf of untruth, and delivering them to safe pasture, all the while finessing his historical skills in his Shepherd's Hut, reading a volume or two. Yes, you've guessed it. It's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another of our Christmas episodes. I hope you're enjoying them. We've done some truly splendid ones so far. Donkeys and stars. And today we are going to be doing the history of shepherds, which is brilliant. I've really enjoyed this one, dude.
I've enjoyed this one. Are you enjoying the run-up to Christmas?
Yes, very much so.
Oh, good, because we are... That was a segue into some cracker jokes. Because we in the Daybell household are obsessed with crackers. As soon as they come on sale, we buy up half a dozen boxes. And this year, we're in fact making our own. We have three birthdays in the run-up to Christmas, each of which demands its own special dinner with crackers, and I just wanted to share with you some of my favourite cracker jokes before we get started. Okay, here we go, Sam. What's green, covered in tinsel, and goes ribbit ribbit?
I don't know.
Mistletoed.
Mistletoed. Oh, damn, it's good.
What do ducks do before their Christmas dinner?
Do they open quackers?
They do. They pull their Christmas quackers. A bit like Elmer Fudd. What does Santa suffer from if he gets stuck in a chimney?
Oh, that'll be flu.
Very good. Claustrophobia. And this one is my total and utter favourite one. What do you call a bunch of chess players talking about chess in a lobby?
This is a complicated one. A bunch of chess... I don't know.
Chestnuts boasting by an open fire.
Very good. Very good.
Anyway, we're not doing crackers. We're doing shepherds.
Yeah, we're doing shepherds. There's so many different ways you can think about it. I became slightly obsessed by... The fact they were doing their tending their flocks in the Christmas story, they're doing it by night, and I realised that you could place these shepherds into the whole history of working night shifts. Ooh. Which I thought was really cool, and you could explore that. I mean, I haven't had much time to go into it, but I think it's worth pointing out that it is interesting that they do have to be awake at night, and I think this would have been very common in nomadic societies and nomadic tribes as well. Then you've got the use of torches or flames, one sort or another, to provide light at night. James talked a little bit about light at night being cast from stars and how everyone's relationship with the sky at night has definitely changed over the years. And I think it's really important to be aware that people would have been very familiar with the night sky, particularly if you were a shepherd watching your flock by night. Obviously, you've got soldiers guarding military camps at night and sailors doing so as well. Those are actually quite easy to get into the histories of because you can look at logbooks, you can look at descriptions of what was going on. Now, interestingly, quite a few battles were fought at night as well. But then you've got this whole change to 24-hour societies as we know them now and the impact of the Industrial Revolution on that and how that, combined with urbanisation, basically demands the creation of shift work, about people having to work for shorter periods of time and then resting and then working again to allow factories or whatever it might be to operate at 24 hours. And I was just really interested in this when I remember working at doing night shifts for the post office when I was a student doing my PhD, doing that over Christmas. But the way that the working world changed, from pre-industrial society to industrial society and now to what's going on now and globalisation, obviously has a massive history. And you can place those wonderful shepherds tending their flocks by night within that story.
Oh, very good. Very, very good, Sam. I love that. I'm going to talk about real shepherds as well, and I've been doing some digging around in Inquisition records about shepherds. But it's also worth, and I've been thinking about this, we've actually been being quite sort of Christian-centric in the way in which we've been approaching Christmas, because, of course, it is a Christian festival that has been sort of secularised and commercialised. But it's worth thinking about where our inspiration for shepherds comes from, and it is because of the Bible, and in particular Luke 2:8-20, where it sets up the story of the shepherds taking care of their flocks at night. An angel then appears to them, tells them not to be afraid, brings them great news. This very day in David's town your Saviour was born, Christ the Lord. And they travel off, find him, a baby wrapped in cloth, lying in a manger. and the angels appear singing praises to God, glory to God in the highest heaven, and peace on earth to those whom he is pleased. The shepherds go off to Bethlehem. They find Mary and Joseph and the baby lying in the manger. And it's worth thinking about what is the relevance of shepherds here. And it is because, you know, in this sort of period in first century Palestine, they were quite lowly in society. And what this shows is that the message of Jesus is for everyone. This is not simply for the wealthy. This is not for the wise men, the kings. It's for everyone, even the most marginalised people. And we can go on from there, thinking about the importance of the shepherds in the way in which we represent the Magi. So they are there. They are there in the adoration of the Magi, along with the wise men, which we talked about in our episode on stars. And there are Christmas carols sung about them, one of which is "While shepherds watched their flocks," which when I was a small boy, we used to say "as shepherds washed their socks at night." And this is one of the sort of earliest permitted hymns, Christmas carols, in the English language, written around 1700 by Nahum Tate. It's based on Luke 2. It's sung to the melody of Winchester Old by George Kirby, and also then by Handel's Christmas. And I think one of the things is about it is that it is, for a while, it's one of the only Christmas hymns to be approved of by the Church of England in the 18th century. And what this meant was that then it was very widely disseminated across the country with the Book of Common Prayer. So it's one of the most widely sung Christmas carols. Other Christmas carols weren't sanctioned by the church because they were often associated with folk music, which was considered far too secular and rustic to be used in formal church services until the end of the 18th century. So there we are, Sam, a little starter for 10 on very why good. Shepherds and the importance of Christmas carols.
I got a bit panicky about costumes for nativities. So how would you identify a shepherd in a nativity visually?
So I have bought many a shepherd's costume for a nativity. Not only have I worn them myself as a small boy, but I have also purchased them for my daughters. The most important thing is a shepherd's crook. That's key. Very difficult to get hold of, but one can furnish one oneself. You can fashion it yourself. But then you also need a sort of a headdress that you wear, and then you need some kind of smock. You can also apply a beard. If you have daughters, this is very important because you need to dress them up as male shepherds or female shepherds, you know, whatever. But often quite humorous to pen on a beard, or not pen on a beard, but, you know, use face paint. That would be what was important for me.
Very good, very good. Okay. Well, I agree entirely, particularly with the crook. And I would like to share. I was idly flicking through the Agricultural History Review of the year 1957. James.
Of course, you were. As was I.
Volume 5, number 2, which is the one I was looking at. Pages 91 to 94, and I came across a brilliant article. It's my new favourite historical article, called Notes, Some Notes on Shepherds' Staves. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about why we think shepherds have crooks, and if they actually did have crooks, and what they were changed for. And I really, really enjoyed this very much indeed. First thing I discovered, I didn't know what the crook was for. Do you know what it's for?
It's for pulling sheep out of places, isn't it? You put it round a sheep's neck when they get stuck in things.
Yeah, or leg, or something like that. So it has become a symbol of Christian care. There's quite a lot of symbolism going on with sheep and shepherds in Christianity. I actually found a really great description here saying, "Our behaviour patterns and life habits are so much like that of a sheep, it's well nigh embarrassing. Sheep are slow, weak, foolish, nervous, fearful, helpless, and most importantly, totally dependent on their shepherd." I'm not sure I completely agree with this. The care of the shepherd profoundly impacts the condition of the sheep. Under one man, sheep would struggle, starve, and suffer endless hardship. In another's care, they would flourish and thrive contentedly. I think that last bit's true, at least. Anyway, you come back to the shepherd and his symbol of having this crook and it being a symbol of care. But this chap who wrote the article, one L.F. Saltzman, basically looked through every visual representation he could find in illuminated manuscripts, paintings, carvings, to try and identify how the shepherd's crook changed over time. And he interestingly only found one or two examples of there being a crook, so having this curved head, like a kind of a over-large walking stick. It's about head height, curved head, often with a little flick at the end. He only found one or two of examples before 1475. Now, before then, what we see most of the time is the shepherd carrying either a plain staff or a stick, basically a long stick, or a club. There are a couple of examples I just want to share with you, which the sources he came across, I just think they were just wonderful. So Chartres Cathedral, a fairly serious demonstration of Gothic art, particularly French Gothic art. It's a masterpiece, the high point of Gothic art and architecture. Carved Western front, very much like the carved Western front of Exeter Cathedral, our local cathedral, where you've got detail of the Annunciation of the Shepherds. This is at Chartres. You've got an angel announcing the birth of Christ. Then you've got several shepherds. And interestingly, they all either have or had, because they've broken off, some form of stick or some form of crook. And one of the ones is, without any doubt, it's a twisted club rather than being the crook that we know. Another example in the V&A museums, where you can find examples of most things in history if you want to. This is a German ivory carving, again from the 13th century. They've got three shepherds, each one with a very plain club. So this has been interpreted as being a weapon, a tool, something used for defence of themselves as well as a defence of the sheep. But, you know, fighting off bandits, but also fighting off wild animals and wolves. So something that's used aggressively rather than that is used to care or to control, which is what the shepherd's crook, as we know it, the long example with the curved head, is used for. Another wonderful example in the Hortus Delicarum of Herad von Landsberg. So this is around 1175, and Herad von Landsberg, or Herod of Landsberg, is our new favourite Alsatian nun. She is an abbess of Hohenberg Abbey in the Vosges Mountains, and she creates this unbelievable manuscript. And it's particularly fascinating for the many observations that you can see in it, which tell us that it was made by a woman. Anyway, it was actually the manuscript itself was destroyed in the 19th century, but there are a few examples surviving, and it has a wonderful example of a club where you've got it's a kind of a thinner at one end, and it's curved into almost like a crook, but it's like an embryo crook. It's not quite a crook. It's like it's kind of an interesting variation, a transition between the simple stick or the club and then the crook. And there are various others around this period, 1200 to 1400, of what is more like a hockey stick or kind of like a 7-iron, if you're a golfer. And then there are others as well, which have spoons on the end, which are really interesting. Or it's like a little spade. And there is some discussion over how these were used. But generally, it's considered that if you're walking along behind your sheep and one strays, you can basically dig up out of the ground a sod of earth, or you can get a stone, and then you can use your crook to flick it much further than you could possibly throw it. And you do that outside the position where the stray sheep is, and that would bring that sheep back into your flock. And this was known as an houlette, H-O-U-L-E-T-T-E. It's a French word. There isn't an English equivalent. So there's a bit more discussion to be had, I think, about how these houlettes work, and also how the houlette, having this spoon or whatever it was on the end, spade, was actually transformed into a crook. Another point to make as well, there are also some wonderful examples in illuminated manuscripts of shepherds playing some kind of form of proto-hockey. They're often depicted with their crook, the one that looks like a hockey stick or a 7-iron, but also with a ball. It's a way of maybe whacking a ball around across the landscape as you are moving through it. So perhaps a little bit of history of sport, particularly the history of hockey, there in the history of the shepherd's crook.
Oh, Sam, that's lovely. One of the things strikes me listening to what you're saying is the connection between that and the Christian church through the bishop's staff or the crozier, which is in the shape of a shepherd's crook. So this is the sort of ceremonial staff that they would have carried in ceremonies, along with the mitre, the pectoral cross and the episcopal ring. And again, it's about the symbolism, or the important symbolism, of the shepherd within the church. You know, Christ is a shepherd of men, and so it emphasises that pastoral role that they would have had. But I want to take us in a different direction and tangential to what your starting point, which was nativities and what would a shepherd look like. I want to riff with that in a different way and to think about oral histories of nativities. And this was inspired by an article a while ago in, I think, the Spectator magazine or something like that, which reviewed various writers, key writers, and their memories of their roles in nativities. And one, John Elledge, who's City Metric editor, was in fact a shepherd. And he writes, I was first shepherd. My first line was, oh, what a wonderful night for stars. I remember giggling really badly during the first rehearsal, saying I'm embarrassed and being shouted at if I didn't pull it together. They'd give the part to someone else, which actually seems a bit harsh. I mean, to be honest, that does seem a bit harsh for somebody who's a small child. And he writes, that is honestly my only memory of the experience. It was about 30 years ago. And it actually made me think about how much these early memories of Christmas stay with you. And then I found this wonderful article in, of all places, the East Anglian Daily Times. And they did a little oral history project a while ago, asking people who grew up in the 50s, 60s and 70s, or even earlier, to remember what their Christmases were like. You know, how did they celebrate it, and all of that kind of thing. And they start off by giving some memories of nativity plays. And they seem to have got this information through Facebook groups, the Ipswich group, and also writers on their staff and that kind of thing. So one, Iris Morris, said that of nativity plays, I was always one of the wise men, as I was tall, and my dad always complained loudly from the audience about me catching my death of cold in my bare feet. We had a wonderful Christmas party put on at the GPO where my brother worked. That's what she remembers. Christine Godfrey Glenn said, us Godfrey girls all had long hair. For some reason, the teachers at Smart Street School in Ipswich thought that made us good candidates for angels. We wore white sheets, tinsel halos and cardboard wings with crepe paper feathers glued on them. Lovely memories. Cheryl Fulcher, who...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Lives in Norwich, remembers, my mum made me an angel dress out of her beautiful 1950s wedding dress at the Avenue's Nativity play. I had a tinsel halo along with 9 other angels. My brother John was playing a policeman in a different play. He became ill and had a pain in his hip. The show must go on, so his teacher made him a police car out of a wooden trolley, and the little milk bottles were carried in so he could still be in the play. That night he was rushed to the Jenny Lind Hospital and was seriously ill for several weeks, and then homed school for months. Adrian Hamilton Watering said, I was always the person who had the most lines at my Sproston infant school in the 50s, which usually meant standing on the side of the stage in full view in Sibley costumes. I remember being a Christmas tree which my mother made out of green material with small fir tree branches sewn onto it. Also a scarecrow with straw coming out of the sleeves, an early Wurzel Gummidge. But it's not just nativities that people remember. They remember all sorts of things relating to Christmas. Many people remember school dinners, including one Judy Rimmer, who said, when I was at school in Framlingham in the 1970s, the dinners there couldn't compete with home food, but I do remember the Christmas dinner being a big event which we eagerly looked forward to. We all queued up for turkey, roast potatoes, stuffing, etc., and had a big plateful. If I remember rightly, everyone had to take something of everything. I'm not sure if we had custard as an option with Christmas pudding. I think there was some sort of sweet white sauce instead as a special treat, though I suspect it would have had any brandy in it. And there were also other things that people remembers. Leslie Firth remembers, I always remember the smell on Christmas morning of the turkey having been cooked overnight. They were wonderful days. The stocking on the bed always contained mandarins and chocolates, then little surprises and a comic. Jean Walker Bayliss recalled, it was Christmas morning 1945. The house was chilly, but after checking my Christmas stocking and finding a new toothbrush, orange and nuts, I could smell breakfast cooking. To the kitchen I hastily went. My mother was cooking real English sausages, scarce during the war, bacon, eggs and mushrooms and fried bread. The radio was playing Christmas music. That was my first Christmas without war. Our dinner was usually a homegrown chicken with sage and onion stuffing, bread sauce, Brussels sprouts, mashed potatoes. It's making me hungry just listening to this. Peas, little sausages around the chicken, Yorkshire puddings, plum pudding with hard brandy sauce, with silver threepence coins, crackers and paper hats to put on. In the afternoon, Dad had a car in 1947. There were visits to grandmother and great uncles, or this could have been on Boxing Day to have high tea with all the goodies. Who needed gifts when we had all that homegrown food? And one of my favourite things that people remembered is playing games with the family. And I love board games at Christmas. It's one of the things that we all love doing as a family. But have you ever, Sam, heard of a game called My Friend's Chair?
No, but I love it already.
Okay. You think about all the things that you act out, charades and other parlour games. Listen to this. This is one Eleanor Ellis writes this, and I think she's alone in this game. The tradition in my family was to play a round of a game called My Friend's Chair after Christmas dinner. Half the guests would leave the room, and those left behind would each choose one of those now absent to be their friend. The first group would come back in one at a time while the room chanted, "This is my friend's chair! This is my friend's chair!" at them, each person patting a chair in an enticing manner. The player would have to decide who was most likely to be their friend and sit down beside them, either to be cheered and allowed to remain or booed from the room. And she adds, the game endured a couple of decades or more until newer members of the family, by marriage, rebelled on the basis that it was not good for their self-esteem. To this day, I've never met anyone else who's ever played this game. I think we should play that this. You should play that this Christmas at your house, Sam, with your family.
I think I will.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, that's my oral history of...
Shepherds.
Yes.
Via chairs.
Via chairs.
Very good. Yeah, very good. Very good. I just briefly tell you about one thing I came across, which I loved. It's by Hans Sebald Beham. Beham. B-E-H-A-M. It is from a pamphlet, which has now been lost. It's a copy. Dating to 1524. It was made in Berlin, and it's called The Sheepfold of Christ. It's a woodcut. Really interesting thing for many, many reasons. So we started off talking about shepherds in the Christian, in the Christmas story, but there's plenty of other examples of sheep going on in the Bible, and people's responses to that over time tells us a great deal about the history of the times in which they live, particularly here, as I say, 1524 Berlin, so the Reformation in Germany. Very interesting time indeed to be studying the way that religious imagery was manipulated and used to reflect different changing beliefs. And this is all based on the parable of the Good Shepherd from John. I am the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who doesn't own the sheep, sees the wolf coming, leaves the sheep and flees. The wolf snatches the sheep and scatters them. The hired hand flees because he is a hired hand and doesn't care for the sheep. I am the Good Shepherd. I know my own and I'm known by my own. Even as the Father knows me and I know the Father, I lay down my life for the sheep. This is a very well-known parable, and it's particularly great in a focus placed upon it during the Reformation. Also, bear in mind that it's not just the Reformation, it's also the 80 Years' War in this period. So in a great deal of cultural reactions and revolts, particularly a revolt here against Philip, the king, and the Pope. And this isn't just about physical fighting. It's all played out as well in propaganda. And one of the ways of this happening was huge through pamphlets, prints, and broadsheets. And here we're looking at an example of a print. They've taken this parable and basically kind of turned it into what you might be more familiar with is a kind of cartoon from the 18th century. What you've got here is a shepherd willing to lay down his life for his flock, unlike the hired hand who flees at first sight of the wolf. And that's essentially the difference between the two. And it could be easily applied to the political reality of the day, not least the fact that Philip II, so he's the King of Spain, was the question here being we're playing with is, was he a good shepherd for his people? And I think a lot of them would have said no at the time. You've also got this parable of the sheep being members of God's flock, contrasted with the cruel wolf. That's the wolf who's going to menace, scatter, and then ultimately devour them. So here you've got the sheep as an obvious metaphor for the faithful, those in the church who are exposed to danger and injustice. And I think particularly during the Reformation, the fear here is that they are exposed to false doctrines. The woodcut itself is absolutely wonderful. You've got Christ standing in a doorway of a wooden sheepfold. He's surrounded by his sheep and he's addressing people in front of him of different social classes. He's encouraging them to come into the sheepfold past him, almost through him. He's talking to a humble peasant couple, which is important because you've got the ideas of the Reformation being particularly resonant for the peasantry and also for the middle class. And at the same time, there are loads of people climbing onto this building. They're trying to get in through the roof, and they're all very clearly Catholics. A Catholic clergy and their monastics, their monks, and they're all scrambling in, trying to get past him. into the protection of the sheepfold. So a wonderful example, James, but one of very many of how German printmark makers use this particular parable of the Good Shepherd to make their point during the troubles of the Reformation.
Oh, Sam, I'm going to take us from the Reformation very briefly to the Inquisition and the Pyrenees in the 14th century. And this is a book, one of my favourite books, and I've talked about it in the past, but if you don't have a copy, go out and buy one for Christmas. It's Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie's brilliant book on Montaigu, which is based on Inquisition records. It's the early 1300s in the village of Montaigu, which is surrounded by mountains in that region of southern France. It's full of heretics. And at the start of the 14th century, Bishop of Pamiers, Jacques Fournier, launches an elaborate inquisition to stamp them all out. And what this book is based upon is all the Inquisition records. And what Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie manages to do is recreate the world of this little Pyrenean village. And one of the sort of sets of people that he's able to tell an awful lot about is the shepherds, because they are people who are caught up in the Inquisition. In fact, see much of their life ruined, social hierarchies challenged, but actually it's the incidental records when they are questioned over Inquisition matters that are so important for us. And what's stunning is that we know such a lot about shepherds from this little village. And there were about 10 of them who are referred to by name throughout these records, and they belong to at least 8 different families within the village, and we know them by name. Guillaume Pellissier, who I'm going to talk a little bit about, Guillaume Bello, Guillaume Guillabert, Jean Marty, Pierre and Guillaume Bale, Pierre et Jean Maury, Guillaume Moors, and one of the Bennett family. They are absolutely everywhere in life that is going on, and they are people who have fairly unorthodox views in themselves. When one of the men was interviewed by the Inquisition, he said, instead of burning heretics, they ought to burn Bishop Fournier himself, because he demands that we pay carnalages or tithes in lambs. And this is something that got him into real trouble. But there, you can get a real strong impression of the lives of these people. And in particular, what I'm going to talk about is the itinerant shepherds who really move around that part of the country. And they form a network of connections in this sort of part of the Pyrenees. And they move from village to village, but still contain strong links to Montaigu. So they fall under the patronage of these people. They often get embroiled in some of the local feuds that happen between the rival clans. And what happens when these feuds take place is that certain shepherds are then told, because of their loyalties and because of their connections, that they have to withdraw flocks from the rivals' lands. But also, what's interesting about them is what we know about their ordinary everyday lives. Several of them are suspected of crimes. And there's one example of a shepherd called Jean Maury, who's somebody who seems to have taken to the road as an itinerant shepherd because he's got into trouble as a result of some sort of scrap or brawl that he's got into. And when he was quizzed about this, what it shows is that basically he's somebody who is really somebody who's sort of filled with wanderlust, so this sort of wanting to actually go walk about. The deposition records, I was involved in a brawl with some shepherds from Raze, in which I was injured. A certain Vesian, who was then living with Raymond Lisier of Montaigu, took my part in the quarrel. I went and lodged a complaint about my injuries with Bernard Clerc, who was then Bailey of Montaigu, acting for the Lord Comte de Faux. I also complained to the Chatelaine of Montaillou. He did not want to compensate me for the injury I had received at the hands of the shepherds. Because of this wrong, I left Montaillou and went to where I hired myself out as a shepherd to the Lady Brunisende de Cervello. I remained with Brunisende and her sheep for 4 years and 2.5 months. And so it's actually one of the reasons that people become shepherds is because they fall out of favour, they get into trouble and therefore have to take on this ruined, this life because their other life has been ruined. And that's fairly representative of many of the shepherds that we see cropping up. But there are other shepherds who just seem to be, actually they choose to have that vocation. They're the younger sons or members of poor families. They're from a lower stratum of rural society and they take on this role as a shepherd, partly because they see themselves as fitted to it rather than having fallen down the social hierarchy. And there's one particular shepherd I want to talk about that we know a lot about because of the records. Quite a lot about him. We know, as Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie says, is that we know that he was, and I quote here, young Pelissier was not outstanding for intelligence, and he made a poor showing beside his colleague Pierre Maury, who was very bright. Pelissier did not know the surname of his first employer and could not say exactly how old he was when Thomas Sear first engaged him. He was just as vague when he was asked to say how long he had worked for her. He said, "I stayed with Tomisia 5 or 6 years." So we know that when he was about 18 and he was an established shepherd, he went home and lived there for an indefinite period with his mother. But then he leaves and goes off again. His wanderlust was boundless, as it says, and he's taken on as a shepherd elsewhere. Then he sets out again for Montaillou and then he sort of goes off again. And so there's this real sort of sense in which he's constantly itinerant, constantly moving around. So you get this sense of somebody without any fixed abode. He's then, the Inquisition then falls upon the House of Moors and he is questioned about it. And he says this: "My employer, Bernard Moors, and his mother, Guillemette, were at that time imprisoned for heresy. Pierre Moors, his brother and neighbour, and the other Pierre Moors, his son, were thrown for a while into prison at Carcassonne. The other sons of Pierre Moors the elder, Bernard Guillem, were also imprisoned in Carcassonne for heresy. Another Pierre Moors, son of Bernard Moors, fled from Montaillou after the raid by the Inquisition on the local heretics, and he settled in Catalonia. He returned to Montaillou 2 years ago, in 1321, in order to marry one of the daughters of Guillem, Authier of Montaillou, now imprisoned for heresy in Carcassonne. This Pierre Moors, before setting out again quite recently for Catalonia, lived in the village until the beginning of this winter and carefully avoided talking to him." So what's extraordinary about this is that we see his motivation for becoming a shepherd, we can see his itinerant life, but also he's an incredible witness to the Inquisition and what happened. But also we get a sense of his day-to-day life, the way in which he works as a shepherd. And this is the last sort of quote that I'll give you here. Was it the year 1308 when all the men in Montaillou were picked up by the Carcassonne Inquisition, or was it the year before? I can't remember very well. Was it during the summer after the hay had been cut, or the spring before the meadows were sown? I can't remember that very well either. I was with my own sheep at Combe de Del Gazelle in the meadow belonging to Guillem Fort and his brothers. I myself was on the left of the meadow by the path which leads to the mountain pastures of Montaillou. To the right of the said path was Pierre Bale, son of Raymond Bale of Montaillou. Pierre Bayle was grazing sheep in the meadow belonging to Bernard Marty, known as Goat. There were also Jean Marty of Montaillou. He was grazing his sheep in the meadow belonging to him and adjacent to that of Raymond Marty. It might have been noon when there appeared upon the said path, coming from Montaillou, Arnaud Vital of Montaillou, wearing a blue surcoat over his tunic and with an axe hanging around his neck and balancing a great faggot of beechwood, which he was carrying round his neck also. With him were two men, each dressed in a brown hooded mantle over a blue or green garment, and they too carried axes over their shoulders. Arnaud and his companions approached through the field belonging to the Bellus. Once they saw me and my associates Pierre Bayle and Jean Marty, Arnaud came up to Pierre Bayle, greeted him, and was in turn greeted by him. And since at that time Arnaud was assistant bailiff of Montaillou, he reprimanded Pierre Bayle and Jean Marty for letting their sheep stray over the sown fields. As a joke, Jean said to Arnaud, "Do these two woodcutters come from Lavalinette?" So what we see from this is not only we see the details of the Inquisition and its tentacles, but also we see in real minute detail the small world of 14th century shepherds in Montaillou. So the attention to detail there about knowing about the different meadows, some that were devoted to hay, some to pasture, divided between sown in field of the parish and distant outfield in the mountain pastures. So there's this sense of, you know, he may not be educated in an intellectual or academic sense, but certainly in terms of his job, he has such a great grasp of detail, and you can really see very clearly the trade that he was engaged in. So there we are, Sam, a medieval shepherd story for you.
Wonderful. All stories of Montaillou are amazing, aren't they? A really, really good place. Really interesting. Thank you all so much for listening to our History of Shepherds. We're going to come back with some more Christmas themed stuff. Yet to decide what they're going to be, but I promise you they'll be super good fun. If you want to find out more about what we're doing, please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis, and if you're interested in maritime and naval history, do please check out the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
I too am on social media. You can follow me on Twitter at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast on at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, so find us there. We have a website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, where you can find out everything that we have been up to. And we are also selling signed books for Christmas. We have our big book, Histories of the Unexpected, and we have four little stocking filler books on the Romans, the Vikings, Tudors, and World War II. If you would like to support what we're doing, be a patron, head over to patreon.com, and anything that you can give to help us change the way in which people think about the past would be much appreciated. But for now, thank you for listening, and take care, and see you soon.
Yeah, we're back in soon, guys. Bye-bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.